Blog Talk Radio.
That was the beautiful music of Denver Pearson, friends, with his love. Life is everlasting with his love, and welcome to Saturday morning. We're back. This is the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. I'm here. My name is Paula Thompson, and I'm with my dear friend, Crystalyn Beek Larson. Crystalyn, are you there?
Good morning. I'm here. Bright and bushy tail.
Great. It's good to be back.
Yeah, welcome back.
We had a snafu last week. We couldn't log into our account. That's one of those things that happens when you're dealing with computers. I know anybody that's ever had a computer knows what that is like, and you kind of go through all of the paces trying to get it to work, and it just isn't going to work, and there you go. You're out of luck. So our show is contingent upon us being able to log in, and we just couldn't. So, hey, we took the day off, and we're back this week with the guest that we promised, Andrea Barnes.
Andrea's here.
With us. I've known Andrea for years. Hi, Andrea. There you are.
Good morning,
I've known
Andrea.
Her for years.
Morning.
We've been outreaching with the Urantia book for quite a while now. And when I first met Andrea, she was engaged in doing a phone call-in program where, not a radio program or anything like that, but she would place ads in local papers for answers from the Urantia book, and then she would do a beautiful voice recording, and you could call into a number and hear the answer from the book. And we did it for quite a while in the Boulder area, and it was really quite successful in
right.
terms of, you know, the big question, like, are angels real? Stuff like that. So, and you're just the most dynamic and beautiful person, Andrea. I'm so glad to have you with us today, and our topic today is learning how to love.
That's a big topic.
So, yeah, it's a big topic. And I know, Crystal, and you're very passionate about this topic, but, of course, who isn't? You know, I mean, I think it's obvious we all need to learn how to love more and better, more sincerely, more genuinely. So I'm going to let you go from here and tell us what you had in mind.
Well, Andrea and I have been talking about this topic for about the last year or so, in terms of putting together a workshop or some type of outreach to work on some of the blocks that get in the way of loving others. We all know that almost all of the great sages and prophets and almost every religionist there's ever been has focused on the concept of love, loving your fellows, loving others, loving all the other beings we live with, that God is love. And if there isn't a sense of a personal God, most of the world's religions at least believe in the value of compassion for others. And we find also that, you know, love and intimacy are at the root of what makes us healthy. You know, we're told that if children don't get love or affection when they're young, they might not survive. But we think that somehow it should be instinctual or that we should know what that means. But I think we all get a very different sense of what love is supposed to mean by the families we grow up in.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really have a lot of other programs in our lives to teach us the actual skill set. Anyway,
right. If we don't love properly, and we don't learn how to love, love can just be another four-letter word for people, you know.
Major four-letter word.
Yeah.
I had a friend who used to say, "Did you ever look at love spelled backwards? It spells evil." I'm like, oh, great. Your concept of love is a little skewed if you think that love is evil, but I think that's the problem. There's a great quote from the Urantia book where the author of the paper is writing about he wishes he had some other word to describe love.
Right, he was pained to have to use the word love because we use love for so many different things. Oh, I love that dress. I love that, you know, music or whatever. And it is too bad that we don't have some more words to use and break it apart a little bit better than we've only got that one word, love, and it gets damaged in the process.
Yeah, here's the quote. I found it. And just to kick us off here, it's from Paper 2, The Nature of God, Section 5, The Love of God. At times I'm almost pained to be compelled to portray the divine affection of the Heavenly Father for His universe children by the employment of the human word symbol, love. This term, even though it does connote man's highest concept of the mortal relations of respect and devotion, is so frequently designative of so much of human relationship that is wholly ignoble and utterly unfit to be known in any word, to be known by any word, which is also used to indicate the matchless affection of the living God for His universe creatures. How unfortunate that I cannot make use of some supernal and exclusive term which would convey to the mind of man the true nature and exquisitely beautiful significance of the divine affection of the Paradise Father.
Wow.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And, of course, you know, not suggesting that humans can manifest love to that degree, but it does tell us that we can manifest sincere and unselfish love, genuine love. Which I think
well, and it tells us, too, that only unselfish love or genuine love is really worth being called love. And it certainly is the only type of love that is really contagious, you know, the kind of thing that transforms our lives and transforms our relationships with others and helps us to grow. I think that's the really...
Right.
The real key to spiritual growth. And many people try to achieve some form of spiritual liberty by, detaching from society or holding off, you know, in a monastery somewhere or in a monastic lifestyle, perhaps.
Right, I've got a little quote here from the Urantia book as well, and it says that love, unselfishness, must undergo a constant and living readaptive interpretation of relationships in accordance with the leading of the Spirit of Truth. Love must thereby grasp the ever-changing and enlarging concepts of the highest cosmic good for the individual who is loved. And so it is that, you know, with each individual... The love is there. There was something that Crystal and I were talking about yesterday, and it's the little quote, thank you for who I get to be in your eyes. And we were talking about how each one of us is the mirror for the other people that we meet and know in our lives. And so it sort of becomes a sacred obligation and responsibility to reflect well to those people in our lives, the people that we come in contact with.
Right. I think you might need to turn off.
Dave, talk to your line, you guys. Dave, are you there?
Somebody has the Dave? Show on with their sound on in the background, and you need to turn that off if you're on the radio program, because otherwise we get feedback.
I think it might be Dave. I'm going to go ahead and mute him again. And
okay.
Dave, are you there? No. Okay. That way we won't have the background noise. Sorry about that, Andrea.
Oh, that's okay. Were you able to hear what I said?
Yeah.
It was, somewhat distracting, but I got the gist of it. I think that
the gist of it is that, you know, we're all mirrors for each other. And so it becomes an obligation, a sacred obligation to reflect well, you know, to look for the good in others and to reflect that back to the person.
Well, and the fact that we get our own personalities sort of reflected back to us through other people is another reason why it's so critical for children to be loved, you know, when they're young and when they're first growing up, to live in an environment where their family is giving them feedback that's very positive and uplifting. And
absolutely.
That hasn't always been the case through our human history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and, Kristen, you said, you mentioned something about, you know, and again, about children getting love and how vital that is. And I remember studying that, they did a several case studies, a huge study on the effects of love on babies, and babies who have love and babies who don't have love. And by that I mean affection and attention, loving touch, interaction with adults that babies normally get from mom and dad, who touch them and play with them and laugh at them and kiss them and cuddle them and hold them. And even, you know, sometimes, you know, well-intentioned parents will set their baby in a car seat or a swing or something just so they can go about their business. But those babies fail to thrive if they don't get enough interaction and enough human love. So and we know now that babies who don't get any can develop attachment disorder and become asocial, which is really dangerous. And so it just goes to show that love is this ingredient in human life that is vital to our happiness and to our health and to our ability to thrive as people, as persons. And I have to think of that you know, when Jesus was with John Mark, and he said, you know, the first 3 years can affect the entire afterlife. And a child's entire afterlife, and his first impression of a child's first impression of his father is his impression of the Heavenly Father, and his first impression of his mother is his impression of the universe. So, you know, those relationships and the love in those relationships are vital, and they're primary to who we are. And I think that, you know, if we have love, the more love we have, it's like a reservoir, the more love we're able to give. So it's just interesting. The topic is interesting to me, how to love, because, you know, obviously some people don't know how to.
Go ahead.
Perhaps it's because they've never been loved, you know.
I think that's really key. One of the quotes that, or one of the paragraphs in your answer book that has influenced me a lot in my life is from paper 100, section 4 and paragraph 6, where it says, "You cannot love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Love is only born of a thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbor's motives and sentiments. It's not so important to love all men today as it is that each day you learn to love one more human being. If each day or each week you achieve an understanding of one more of your fellows, if this is the limit of your ability, then you are certainly socializing and truly spiritualizing your personality. Love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate, but only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. If each mortal could only become a focus of dynamic affection, this benign virus of love would soon pervade the sentimental emotion stream of humanity to such an extent that all civilization would be encompassed by love. And that would be the realization of the brotherhood of man." And if we just look at that first sentence, that we cannot truly love our fellows by a mere act of the will, when someone spiritually is commanded to love others and they don't know how or that word or that topic seems sort of vague or nebulous. This paragraph sort of focuses us inward to this idea that we need to understand other people. We need to learn their motives and sentiments. So
we learn those things by asking them good questions, by not making assumptions about what other people are thinking, projecting our own stuff onto other people. It's very easy to misunderstand people. And so one of the things that Crystalyn and I have been discussing is this idea of making assumptions, taking things personally. We've been talking about the book, The Four Agreements. And, you know, how do you get beyond some of these things that are so easy for all of us to do?
And also so difficult for us to overcome our sort of natural instinctual defensiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if we were raised where we got a lot of criticism or we had some emotional or physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
How challenging that can be to overcome, because we may not really understand what love looks like. And, you know, from what you were saying, Paula,
what
about how much confusion there is around that word?
Well, and, you know, I mean, and imagine, too, you know, I love you, slap, slap, slap. I love you, you little, you know, turkey, you idiot, you. You know, I mean, no wonder children can get confused, because parents, you know, love is so easy to say. It's so easy to say, I love you, you know. Really, I love you. But, you know, I'm going to tear you to ribbons now. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that most people approach, you know, they're just children in that, they don't themselves, I mean, even adults, even parents, they don't realize that what a profound effect the words they say have on this little psyche, or even have on this partner or this friend. You know,
right.
There's a beautiful internet flash presentation that really took the whole World Wide Web by storm when it first came out. It's called The Interview with God. And it's based on a dream a man had. He actually had a dream where he had an interview with God. And when he woke up, he wrote it all down. A good friend of his took it and put it into a flash presentation with music and beautiful images. It's very, very simple. And 2 days after she launched it, it crashed her site. She got, you know, it literally, of course, it was one of the first to go viral, and it set a precedent. And it's just called The Interview with God. And in it, God says, you know, he asked God, what would you tell your children if you could? And God says, I would tell them that it only takes an instant to open up a profound wound in another human being, but it can take years and years and years to heal it.
Mm.
You know,
and,
that is the most watched video on the internet.
That still is, huh?
Yep. Since the year 2000, this is the most watched video on the internet.
Wow.
Well,
it's pretty important.
And you've not seen it, Andrea?
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm going to.
Oh, it's amazing. It's so amazing. And I think why it's amazing is it's just so poignantly beautiful and simple, you know. That's what makes it so good.
What's it like?
Yeah, I'll put a link to it on the chat board, folks. And also, we have a caller. It might be Dave. Should I go ahead and patch it to you?
Yeah.
Let's see who we've got here. 754, area code 754, you're on Blog Talk.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, this is George. How are you?
Oh, George.
George.
From Canada?
George Gordon. I'm in Florida.
Oh, Florida.
George Gordon. Hi, George.
Hey,
how are you? A phone call.
I was chatting with you yesterday.
Yes.
Thank you for calling
in. I'm so
glad
you called.
I just came on about 5 minutes ago to the call, so I'm just listening.
Do you want to continue listening, or would you like to join us in the conversation?
I can join, but I listen for the first, and then I chip in with something later on.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Very good.
You know, one thing that I'd like to throw out here is earlier one of you was reading from the book about how their pain to use the word love when they talk about the relationship that we have with God, the way that God loves us. And, you know, when you have a worshipful meditation and you feel God's love, you really realize that wow, this goes way beyond any word that you could ever put with it. You can't even hardly describe it. Afterwards, you know, it's just, it goes beyond words, that sort of love. But that's the type of love that helps us become infectious. And so worship and prayer is such an important part of healing the wounds that we have. I think that deep prayer and worship are part of what can really help heal the wounds that all of us have. I've got a little quote here from A Course in Miracles that I like. It says, "If we but knew the meaning of God's love, hope and despair would be impossible, for hope would be forever fulfilled, and despair of any kind unthinkable, if we knew the meaning of God's love."
Mm.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so true.
And so true.
If we really understood what that love was about, it would be almost impossible for us to be insecure.
Right.
To feel, I mean, think about that. What a significant thing that is to say.
Right, and it's about faith. When that faith does extinguish, insecurity, and it helps extinguish some of these wounds. It's such a healing power.
Here's the thing about, and Kristen, I love the quote you shared. Jesus also said in many ways that the way that we will come to love each other is by knowing each other, and the quote you read says we've got to get to know our neighbor's motives and sentiments. And that's no easy thing to do. I mean, I think in some ways the biggest block to relationships is, frankly, human laziness. We understand that relationships take effort, and some people are easy to love, and others are just really tough, and they require a lot more effort. And so, it's easy to just say, well, I've heard these terms bandied about a lot lately, that person is just way too high maintenance for me,
mm-hmm.
or too needy.
But what, Paula, what's that quote in the book that talks about how the harder a person is, the greater their need for love?
Yeah, that's about divine love. Hold on, I'll get it. And it's such a beautiful quote.
Mm-hmm.
Divine love. It says, let's see, maybe I got the wrong one. Hold on. I don't know what I'd do without folio.
I know, huh?
Sometimes it's hard to find just exactly the place you want without it.
I've been quite inspired over the last week.
It's still a challenge. Lou is on the board, and he's pretty darn good at it. hat's off to Lou.
I just love Lou.
We all love
Lou. Lou, we love you, bro. Our hat's off to you. He's on the board. He's blushing by now.
Yeah.
Anyway, paper 156, section 5, Jesus is teaching at Tyre. So what you're asking for, Andrea, is the words of Jesus. And just such a great quote on love. He says, "You are destined to live a narrow and mean life if you learn to love only those who love you. Human love may indeed be reciprocal, but divine love is outgoing in all its satisfaction seeking. The less of love in any creature's nature, the greater the love need. And the more does divine love seek to satisfy such need. Love is never self-seeking, and it cannot be self-bestowed. Divine love cannot be self-contained. It must be unselfishly bestowed."
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And that unselfishness also can sometimes require us to have more divine perspective. Another quote from the conversation or interview with God is to learn that there are people who love them dearly but simply have not yet learned how to express or show their feelings. And to learn that two people can look at the same thing and see it differently. And it is so true that many times we project an unloving thought or an unloving fantasy almost on someone else.
A judgment.
And frequently it's someone who we believe is judging us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really what someone else thinks about us does not really define us. We might feel
how could it? And yet we fall into that trap.
There's a book. It's an old book. It's called What Other People Think of Me Is None of My Business. And I think that's something to take to heart there, just those words.
But then again, if we bring it back to childhood, what the people we live with think of us is very important to us when we're very young, like when you said about the first 3 years of life. I think that as children, we need a great deal of love. And as we grow up, we learn how to bestow that love outward.
Right. And we need good mirrors when we're young. We need that reflecting back of, you know, of who we are and the love that's within us so that we can become good mirrors for other people.
Well,
so
how can we do that?
The other night in study group, someone brought up Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And a lot of people that I've met consider that one of the most important books they've ever read. And one of the things that he says early on in the book is about criticism and how to avoid it at all costs because of what it does to a person. And I think this is the challenge, and this is the example that Jesus gives us, and the example from the Urantia book of the human Jesus and how he raised his brothers and sisters and how he dealt and interacted with his fellow men and women. He wasn't critical. He was loving. And the admonitions that he gave and the lessons that he taught were in the positive. He didn't say thou shalt not. He said, you would do well to do this. And he didn't attack a person character. He just gave them something. He didn't take anything away. In other words, he gave them something. And the thing that he gave them was like the leaven in the dough. He would find the best in them. Like, I'll just give you an example. When he came upon the man that was abusing his wife in public, and he enters this situation as a total outsider. And in many instances, if somebody did that, it would get him punched right in the face. If this man had a full head of steam and he was mad at his wife and he's going to transfer that anger But Jesus tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Excuse me, may I speak to you in private for a moment?" And the man said, "Well, yeah." And so Jesus pulled him aside and he said, "What is it that could make you, a man like you, abuse his wife like this and even out in public? I dare say that if I was accosted and left bleeding on the roadside, you would do everything in your power to help me. In fact, you're a good and courageous man. I see that in you. So why would you abuse her in public?" So he immediately affirmed the goodness in this man. He didn't say, "Excuse me, but you're really a jerk. You know, how could you do that to her?" He didn't do that. And that's part of tact and diplomacy, but that's also part of who he was. He saw goodness in humanity. He saw the goodness there. He recognized it and knew it and honored it and affirmed it.
And for us, that's very hard. For us, that's very hard to do. You know, when we, especially in the heat of the moment, you know, it's, you don't think like that unless you've got even some good psychological techniques. You know, like for us, it would have been, we would have had to really think hard to try and handle that situation. With Jesus, it was just like you said, he just absolutely saw the goodness in that man. For us, it's, I think, a little bit more of a struggle, but we have to go with that thought that you know, and focus on the goodness in others, even when things get rough.
Yeah.
Well, and
you know,
especially
that's
when
our
things
challenge.
Get rough.
What, Crystal? I'm sorry.
I said, and especially when things get rough.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when we feel hurt, or we feel injured, or we feel misjudged, or we feel like our motives are being questioned, or we feel attacked. How can we respond? Pardon me?
We're picked on.
Oh, yeah. How can we respond out of a place of security? And
mm-hmm.
My belief is that's why those two things go hand in hand. Knowing that we are a child of God and that we have an eternal purpose and an eternal destination and a perfection destination. That is a very critical part of the puzzle. Knowing that we are a unique child of God, that our personality is a direct bestowal of the Heavenly Father, and that, you know, we are paradise bound. Our goal is to be with Him. And that the second part of that truth is we need to devote ourselves and our lives to proving that love is the most powerful force present in the universe. And we demonstrate that by outgoing love, so that when someone attacks us, we can offer love in return. And Jesus, of course, is the best example we've probably ever had of that. Not probably, absolutely the best.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? I mean, if we accept what he tells us, that we are the beloved children of God, and he was able to act so loving and have such a gracious personality because he really did know that about himself. He didn't have any self-esteem issues.
No. And that's sort of the root of a lot of the problems that we're talking about here. When you have problems, it's because somehow you do feel less than or attacked or whatever the case might be. That's what sets off, you know, a reaction within ourselves that that happens when and then we don't feel, what am I trying to say here? I got a truck outside of my window and they're getting ready to turn the power off in the house. I'm a little bit distracted. But that's what causes those knee-jerk reactions where we behave inappropriately sometimes, is when we feel like we've been misunderstood.
Even go ahead, Paula. No, you go. You go.
No, but I I was just going to say that, you know, I think you touched on something so important, and here's the crux of it. Jesus said at one point, we've come to restore the self-esteem in those who have lost it and to restrain it in those who have it. And another time he said he would stop at nothing to restore the self-esteem of someone who had lost it. The book says that his goal in life was to achieve a superb self-respect, which is not self-love. It's not the same thing. And self-respect is at the essence of your ability to love each other dynamically, to love other humans. In fact, he said that when you lose self-esteem or self-respect, you experience a paralysis of the will. Think about that for a minute, a paralysis of the will. And in other words, and what that means for me is that now I can't love, I can't decide, I can't do anything because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of I'll mess everything up. I have no confidence in myself to do anything right. So I experience a paralysis of my will because I have no self-respect. And I'm not saying that's true about me per se. I'm just saying as an example, a person who has no self-respect would experience this. And so then, you know, they have nothing to give. They can't act. And in order to love, love is dynamic. We just read it. Love is dynamic. And it's outgoing. And without that base to jump off from and to come back to, that center of self-respect and self-esteem, there's nothing but fear. And fear is not dynamic. Fear is cringing. Fear hides. Fear is, obviously afraid to act or say or speak or do anything. And love calls for us to take a chance.
That's
love
right.
Calls
and
for us to reach out and... Go ahead, Auntie.
I just think that it's so important for us to sort of get a grip on our heads about really how important it is to get out there and love other people and to not be afraid of anybody and to go out and focus on others and to show that affection, to get to know people. They gave us a challenge, find one new person a day to love, and that's huge. I've certainly never lived up to that, but it's such a nice mandate to get out there and love and to not be afraid and to learn about other people, and people love that. They want, people are hungry for somebody that will listen to them and learn to love them and reflect back to them who they are. We all need that.
Oh, my. You know, Lou just posted two really great quotes on the board, and I want to read them just for the benefit of our listeners who can't see this. Three, actually, and it touches on what I just said. It is the purpose of this gospel to restore self-respect to those who have lost it and to restrain it in those who have it. That's the first one. The second one. Self-respect is not self-admiration. Self-respect is always coordinate with the love and service of one's fellows. It is not possible to respect yourself more than you love your neighbor. The one is the measure of the capacity of the other. And then the last one he posted, love is dynamic. It can never be captured. It is alive, free, thrilling, and always moving. Man can never take the love of the Father and imprison it within his heart. The Father's love can become real to mortal man only by passing through that man's personality.
That's right. I mean, How does God love us? He loves us through others loving us, as well as, you know, within our own heart. We have him within us. But the other way we feel God's love is through our brothers and sisters.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And if we...
Go ahead, hon.
If we do respond that way with others, if we do respond as if we take for granted that we are beloved, that even when someone is attacking us, that it's not personal, we can begin to develop those sort of Jesus-like responses. You know, as our friend Aurora says, let's learn to respond instead of to just reacting. And when an attack does come at us, whether it's a verbal attack or a physical attack, you know, to just sort of stand aside and let it go past and observe it, or just try to learn what it's about. And if we had a way of learning those skills earlier in life, I think it would serve us really well. Not only serve us personally, but serve us socially and civilizationally. You know, in the Arantia book, it talks about how critical it is for parents, a husband and wife or spouses, to really love each other. It says that one of the best ways for a man to be a good father is for him to love the mother of his children. We're told
that. And they say
that
also that when the parents love properly with each other, then the child doesn't get overindulged. The child doesn't become something that comes between the parents, where the child gets used as, you know, something that the can happen between the parents. So it's very important for the parents to love each other and put their relationship first.
Yeah. And to express affection to each other and in front of their children. Not only to express affection to the children, but to show affection towards each other. And yet that's probably one of our most challenging loves. One of the most challenging relationships that we have is with our mates, with our family, with those who are closest to us. And how can we begin to manifest the kind of love, loving families, loving relationships that it's talking about here? And I think that one of the ideas that I'd like to put out there is that we can make covenants with each other. We can make contracts with each other. That we will, I mean, it's kind of like the Andon and Fanta contract. If you think about one of the very first moral acts ever made by the first two human beings, was that they would live for each other. That they would love each other.
You know,
isn't that amazing?
Crystal, when we were talking the other night, you were saying that a contract that you can have with a person that you're in a relationship with is, number one, to say that God is sovereign in our relationship and that we'll always turn to God with problems that end up stymieing us, and
right.
That you'll promise to always have an undying and underlying friendship with that person, and you promise to be friends because, as we know, we're friends in eternity, so why not, you know, commit to it here?
Exactly. And that is such a very important part of this process, is that as human beings, as friends, as beloveds, we cannot afford to divorce one another. And I don't mean that in the literal term. I mean it in the metaphorical term, that this relationship that we have is a sacred thing. It is an end in and of itself, and it is an eternal thing. And if we learn to treat each other as if our relationships are those eternal and divine and sacred things, we can help each other on that path. And one of the ways we can help each other is by not getting hurt, not getting our feelings hurt. You know, when our spouse or our significant other has a blowout, I don't know if that's ever happened to either of you ladies, but it has happened
never.
To me. Well, hypothetically, you know, we all break down. We're not perfect yet, and we do have difficulties sometimes being our best when we're really stressed out or we're overtired or we're hormonal or whatever it is. We blow out and we attack those people we love the most. And
you know, I would like to add something too here. I would like to say that even Jesus got his feelings hurt. He sat in the boat and wept when all of the families of all of the other apostles came down to say goodbye, but his own family didn't bother.
Mm.
It hurt his feelings. Being spiritual doesn't mean that you're impervious to hurt. I think this is really important to understand. Being spiritual, even deeply spiritual, even perfectly spiritual, doesn't mean you don't feel. Doesn't mean others can't hurt you. What it means is you recover very quickly and you move on. And you find your balance again and your center again. You don't dwell on it. And Jesus was a superb example of that. But even Jesus wept. Even Jesus felt deeply, keenly for his fellows and because of his fellows. And I think that's a lesson for all of us, to the degree to which we can hurt each other inadvertently, thoughtlessly. You know, yes, sometimes we're tempted to take it out on the people we love the most. But we have to resist that. We have to resist it because it doesn't help. In the end, it doesn't help. And so part of being in a loving relationship and part of being a lover of any person, whether it's your friend or your child or your husband or your wife, is learning how to communicate what you're feeling in non-hurtful ways. And certainly we humans, if we love each other, we understand, oh, man, you're just stressed out, you're tired, and you're taking it out on me. You know, and if I'm stressed out and tired, my resistance is low. And now we're going to get into a big knockdown, drag-out fight, and that ain't going to help anybody. Let's find another way. And sometimes it's just being present in the moment, present enough to say, whoa, wait. Let's rethink this before we go here, you know?
Yeah, that's the moment you have to capture.
Yeah.
The moment you have to capture and say it, whoa, and walk away or do whatever. And that can be very difficult.
It really can. So how do we practice this to get better at it? How do we begin to show that startling affection?
Well, I have something here that I've been really inspired the last week by a man named Richard Knox. You can find him on the internet, richardknox.net. He's got a great website, and I just completed a video slideshow. You can go onto YouTube and type in Richard Knox. You should be able to find it there, and it's called Gazing at You. It's music and slides. But here's something that he wrote off of his website. I'm just going to read. It's about two paragraphs, but it's quite good, and I think it goes with what we're talking about here. He says that the wisdom books of all religions agree. Becoming as a little child is the key to entry into paradise. The golden rule is the passport we hold to practice our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven, where we are finally safe from the small part of ourselves, the part where we fall short of living up to our vows not to injure another. We become duty-bound by the principles of the Golden Rule, the human family code shared by all religions, the practice of loving each other as we would like to be loved. And what we find is that the door to the room of the Golden Rule is locked, and the lock on the door is our judgment, and the key to the lock is our returning to innocence. When we have recognized the lock and found the key and bravely opened the door, what we step into is a room full of mirrors, where we see only ourselves reflected back to us and begin to see that as we treat our neighbors, we are treating ourselves. Slowly, we become comfortable, then familiar with acknowledging and understanding, even knowing that what we think and say and feel about another, we are thinking and saying and feeling about ourselves. One more little line here. Our neighbor then becomes a gift to us, a blessing in disguise, showing us ourselves, mirroring back our inner life. When we see a wanting to withdraw our love, a wanting to defend, or an unwillingness to forgive, or a wanting to punish, we admit freely we don't want to be treated that way, and so we become duty-bound by the human family code, the principle of the Golden Rule, to practice not treating others that way.
Did you know Richard Knox is a UB reader for many years?
What's that?
He's read the UB, Urantia book for many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He actually used to study with the LA folks, and he is a gifted singer and songwriter. And
yeah, I highly recommend going on YouTube and checking out the presentation that's out there. It's really good. It's called Gazing at You. I think that if you just type Gazing at You, maybe you'll find it. It's just recently put out. So
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I the guy is amazing. We actually should have him on the phone or on the show sometime.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because, yeah, he's a really, really fun guy to talk to and so deeply sincere and a true interfaither, does the universal dances of peace. You know, he calls himself a troubadour of the spirit, which is really pretty cool. And yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for reading that, Andrea.
Yeah.
I'd like to continue with where you.
Go ahead.
I was going to say I'd like to continue talking about where you were heading right before that too. That you know that we need to forgive each other, and that we need to practice not judging in the first place. Like Richard,
and that starts with forgiving ourselves, which is probably the harder than even forgiving other people.
Well, and I think we forgive ourselves by acknowledging who we are and where we are in our process, in our progress, in our growth. You know, we're not even really considered fully born yet, really, in the universe sense. We're practically still in utero, you know, on this planet.
Right.
And you know, we're definitely only a couple of millimeters up the evolutionary scale, so to speak, above, let's say, our primate cousins. You know, my dad likes to point out that men have more genetic material in common. Male humans have more in common with male chimpanzees than they have with female humans.
No kidding.
And that female humans have more genetically in common with female chimps than they do with male humans. And the differences there are really minute. Even so, they are that we have these gender differences that we cannot overcome those. We never
they say
will.
That we never do. Yeah, we never overcome those differences.
We will
That's
never
so interesting.
Completely understand the opposite sex. They will continue to intrigue and inspire us. And how cool is that? But
yeah.
It sort of gives you an idea that, you know, when we expect our mate to understand us, especially when we expect them to understand us when we're not communicating clearly what we want or what we expect or what we need.
Well, you know,
we're being unreasonable. It's completely impossible for even someone who knows us really well to read our mind.
Well, you know, I think expectations by definition are many times unspoken. You know, you just think, well, yeah, it's an expectation, and it really goes right to your heart. It's almost unconscious. Of course I expect this. They must know that. I mean, you know, they've got to know this about me.
Yeah, they should know me by now.
Mm-hmm.
But we're always growing and learning and changing. And we react to the same kind of stimuli differently at different times in our lives. And as we grow, our minds are also growing. We begin to think differently and respond and react differently. And we can make a relationship with another human being a constantly evolving adventure. It does not have to become boring and humdrum and taken for granted. There's always something new and interesting to learn in another human being, whether it's your
and
brother
in
or
yourself.
Sister, or, and in yourself.
Something interesting to learn about yourself as well, you know, always. Something you didn't know. And oftentimes you'll learn that from a brother or sister, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
From somebody that, you know, that will open up a part of you that you didn't know was there. Just by something they say or do in an interaction with them. And, you know, I like to say people are like presents waiting to be unwrapped. If you will create a safe space for them, they will unwrap themselves for you and show you the most beautiful things. But
and they will help unwrap, and they will help unwrap you as well.
Yeah, exactly. And show you
and
something beautiful about yourself.
It's kind of like one of those boxes. My mom has this this box. You open it up, and then there's another box inside. And then you open that one, and there's another box inside of that. And there's about 12 of them, you know.
I love those things.
Yeah.
For some reason. I've loved those things
it's like
all
those,
my life.
Those nesting dolls, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You get down to the tender little core, that little baby doll that's at the very center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially who we are. And the goal is to make a place safe enough for that person to come out and play.
Right. And if we get in touch with that sacred part of ourselves, and we truly, you know, feel that love and we love ourselves, it's just that much easier to put that out. So it all starts right inside of our own hearts.
Right.
Well, and have you ever seen kids, young kids, what they do when they meet other kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they might, you know, be a little hesitant at first, sort of testing the water to find out if it's a safe place to play. But most of the time, they pretty much take it for granted that it is a safe place to play, and they'll just start playing with each other.
Right.
Girls, they found out, will spend some of that time getting to know things about the people they're playing with. Little boys won't. They don't care. They just want to play. And, you know, after a day of, you know, being at, let's say, day camp or something like that, a boy can come home and can have a great time. And mom can ask, well, who were you playing with and what were you doing? And, well, I was playing with Johnny and I was playing with Tommy and I was playing with David. And we had a great time. And where do they live and where are they from? Oh, I don't know. And I think that as women, as girls, we sometimes expect the same kind of social habits from our mates that they're just not that way. And especially when we expect them to read our minds.
They've done extensive testing on this with children. How deep do these differences go? How far back do they go? And they have found that they go all the way back. And they've done testing, for instance, I'll just give you some examples. You put a 15-month-old girl in a little pen and mom walks away, she will invariably melt down and start to cry. You put a 15-month-old boy in the same situation and mom walks away, he will start to try to figure out a way to get out of the pen and go further. It's invariable. You put a 4-year-old girl in a group social situation, and she will immediately seek out the other 4-year-old girls in the room, and by the end of the time they're together, they'll be holding hands and interacting socially. You put a 4-year-old boy in a room, he'll go find toys and go in a corner and play by himself. You know, we are hardwired for this stuff. And so, you know, we women get frustrated because men don't want to open up and share and relate. That's not who they are. And, you know, and they get frustrated with us because we don't shut up. You know, we just want to talk and relate all the time. But that's who we are. And so the balance between male and female is trying to understand those basic differences, even though it's not a part of your reality. And if you can't, you know, at least you can respect them. You know, you can respect that, hey, that's not who they are. I'm barking up the wrong tree if I want him to go to the, you know, the coffee clash with me. Because he's not comfortable there. It's not a, you know, something he really wants to do. Of course, you know, you can't paint all men with that same brush and all women, obviously, but it's just an interesting thing. They've done another study. You know, they did a lot of studies on how men relieve stress, but they never studied how women do it. And they did this study on it, and they found that women relieve stress by talking to each other. That's how we relieve our stress. We'll call up a friend and say, man, you'll never believe what happened to me. You know? And
what
and
a day
it,
I've
it
had.
Yeah, it works for us. And we do that. We listen for each other, and we're there for each other, and we empathize with each other, and we have compassion with each other, and it so works for us. But, you know, there can be a pathology to that, too. You know, you can end up not liking someone else because that person was such a problem for your friend. But, you know, I want to go back to something that you guys said earlier, and that's judgment. Because it's so important, and I have this thought that we buy it and sell it. If we sell it, and if we buy it, if someone sells us a judgment and we buy it, we're destined to sell it to someone else. And there's a real good example of that in the news lately, of this woman on I can't remember what it's a big news site. And, I think it's Marie Claire Magazine, which is a huge style icon. You know, Marie Claire Magazine is a fashion icon. And she went off on her blog, she went off on a big rage about this show that has a fat couple that meet each other and fall in love. I can't think of the name of it now. It's a sitcom that just came out this year, about two fat people that meet each other and fall in love. And Molly and Mike, I think is the name of it. Anyway, she went off on this saying, you know, oh, how disgusting. I don't even want to see fat people walk across the room, let alone see them try to kiss each other. Oh, yuck. And she just went on and on. And it had an unintended consequence. A bunch of the readers of her blog were outraged by her comments. And so then she had to backpedal, and then it comes out that she's a bulimic. And that she has literally tortured herself to be this person, that because she, obviously she feels so strongly about being overweight that she has to punish herself in order to accomplish that. And
right,
and
you judge others the way you judge yourself.
Right, exactly. She bought that judgment, and now she's selling it big time.
Right.
And then we find out, you know, what personal torment she goes through, and obviously, you know, shaming and blaming and disenfranchising and making a whole segment of people feel like they're not worthy doesn't help the situation. That doesn't make them feel better and want to change something.
Right. Watching our words.
All too often.
Go ahead.
What, Andrea?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, Krystalyn and I have been talking about the four agreements and how that what you're talking about comes under, I think it's the very first agreement, which is to be impeccable with your word. And Ruiz, I think, is the author's name. He says, never gossip about yourself or others. I mean, never gossip about others. That's, you know, we think of that and we know that, but we don't think so much about gossiping about ourselves. You know, we think that that's somehow okay, but he's saying that, that even that's not good.
Gossiping about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's about a boundary, and sometimes, you know, you just find somebody you love and you share, you know, like with women, for example, and I think the three of us could speak to this because we are women. I mean, you know, it's hard to say what men do to relieve their stress. They probably slam some beers and watch a game or something and yell
or
and get all into
do something mindless. Do something that doesn't require for them to think or to problem solve.
Right. Maybe so. I mean, there's some men out there on the board and they're, Bro David saying, women relieve stress by screaming full blast at their husbands. And then Patrick Yes said, not always, sometimes they cry. So, you know, I wish one of you guys would call in and tell us how men, you know, so that in this exploration of how we can love better and more, we understand what it is that men need to do to relieve stress. And that would help us, certainly. I can't pretend to know how that happens. I've watched them in action. For years, and I know that, for instance, I'll give you for instance, my husband goes hunting every year, and they go up into the wilderness, build a big campfire, and they sit around the campfire, and they drink a few beers, and then they get all sentimental, and they talk about things they can't talk about with us, but they can with each other, but it takes a certain situation where they feel like they're sufficiently out in the wilderness and nobody's around to hear them, that
mm-hmm.
they can, you know, they can share what's deep inside there, and they feel safe to do that.
I've always
and
thought
that
it's interesting. I've always thought it's interesting to see how when you have women in a group, you have a certain dynamic. There's only women there. If one man walks into the room, things change. I'm sure it's the same. When there's a group of men together, there's a dynamic going there. Just one woman walks in and everything changes. You know, it's interesting how we have these genders and how we communicate with each other when it's just, you know, men or just women.
Exactly. And that, of course, is, you know, speaking of how to love better, that's the primary relationship that is the most challenging, the one between the opposite sexes. So, and family, Chris, and I think you said that earlier too. That's where the rubber meets the road. It's you know, sometimes it's much, much easier to love somebody you only see once in a while and you can be on your best, no big deal. But
there's an
when you're at home,
There's an old saying that says, don't flatter yourself to think that being close to a person allows you to just speak your mind, because the closer you come into a relationship with a person, the more important do tact and courtesy become. Only in situations which are rare, you know, should you speak your mind, you know, and really, you know, be critical with a person. And the saying goes, let that person's enemies do that for them. You know, just stay loving with that person and don't worry about telling them what their issues are, no matter how close you come into a relationship with them.
It goes back to that thing Carnegie said, don't criticize.
Well, and realizing, too, that we right. process information really differently from each other, like between men and women. You know, like you can walk away from the same conversation with completely different understandings of what was just discussed. You know, a particular writer says that there is proof that neither of you is crazy. You're just completely different. And it's not completely clear how the structural differences in the male and female brains affect their function. But scientists theorize that the most likely impact is upon the way we process information. You know, we've probably all seen that speaker who does the little shtick about the difference between men and male and female brains. And he talks about the male brains being like boxes, and they have a box for everything that they do. And when they're going to perform a particular task, they go and they get that box out. And they open up the box, and then they perform whatever task they have to do in that box. And when they're done doing that, they put it back in the box and they put it away. And one of their favorite boxes of all that women simply do not understand is the nothing box. And they love spending time in the nothing box, you know, where they're just literally thinking about nothing. And then he goes on to say, there's nothing that drives a woman crazier than when her mate is sitting there doing nothing. And he talks
no,
about...
No, you guys, hate to interrupt. We have two callers. So
okay.
Go ahead and finish your thought, Crislyn, and then we'll take a couple of
that's
calls.
That's why they enjoy things like fishing. And not that there aren't any women out there who enjoy fishing, too, but just that it's just a different frame of mind. And then he goes into a description of the female brain, and he says, their brain is more like a bunch of jumbled up wires that are all connected to all the other wires in their brain. And they very easily go from one topic to another in the same train of thought. And that can just drive men crazy, because they think that's not what we were talking about. How did we get over here?
That's so true. Okay, let's see what we got here. Is it area code 200? Are you with us?
Hello.
Hi.
This is Dave. How are you?
Hi, Dave.
Good.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling in.
Are you here to defend yourself?
No, absolutely not. I don't. You know, I'm trying to get to a point where I don't think there's a right or a wrong, you know. It's just what is. So it's where I'm at's kind of a challenge. I'm in love with a person that I was married to for a number of years, and I have a 7-8-year-old daughter. And my deal is that I've been in a lot of relationships, but this particular one takes me back to when I was a child, where this woman can't really make up her mind. Things change from day to day, and it's kind of drastic. We were, I recently was foreclosed in my home, so I moved in with her, and we started having a relationship, and then the relationship was on and it was off, and we were moving to another place, and that move was on and it was off. And, you know, there's a little bit of alcohol involved in some you know, I guess what they call them, psychotropical drugs involved. But, you know, other than that, I just have no clue where or what to how to really support someone when they can move from one place to another. I'm kind of in amazed. I've spent a lifetime, you know, in relationships like this. So my interest is, you know, well, what's wrong with me that I keep having this same relationship? So that's kind of where I'm at, and I'd like a woman's input on that.
You said that this brings you back to your childhood. What's that about?
Well, my mother actually was the same way. She would say one thing, and then, you know, a little bit later, she'd be saying another thing. And I seemed to be kind of dyslexic. I was standing there watching two people show up.
So this feels like home. This is family. This is familiar.
Well, yeah, but I tell you what, although it feels like home and family and familiar, it's not comfortable. And no longer tolerable.
Well, that's the key, right? It's no longer tolerable is the key. And that, you know, the fact that you've identified it, you can identify maybe why you fall into the trap. And I think that's what Andrew was saying. It feels familial. And so, you know, your initial response to a woman that reminds you of your mother. I think it's classic. I think people often fall for somebody that reminds them of their parent, even though that primary relationship wasn't very healthy. And then they're in that situation again, and now it feels just as uncomfortable as it did when you were a child. But identifying it, I think, is the first step, and then realizing that initial attraction. Go ahead.
The feeling part of it is one thing, but then it's the action. See, my action in the past has been, okay, well, I'm going to get up and leave, you know. But now I'm realizing that I'm really dealing with somebody that it doesn't matter what they say. So what do I really do? Where do I really begin? That's the challenge.
You have the choice to not give up on this person. I mean, and that's important. You obviously love this person.
But well, I love myself. I love myself, and I would like to be in a complete scenario. I don't think it has anything to do with her so much. You know, I'm a life coach, and I study this stuff, and I'm excellent at what I do. But when it comes to me, I have no clue. But I do know one thing, that I am only trying to achieve self-fulfillment, and that is to do a proactive thing in a circumstance where proactivity doesn't make sense. So that's kind of where I'm at. You know, somebody says, okay, well, this is what I want, but I know yesterday it was different, and I know tomorrow will be different. So what is it that I can really do to be in a very deep commitment to serving someone, not in a dysfunctional way, but in a proactive way, since she is the mother of my daughter. You know, how do I formulate my own decisions?
I think that one of the things that's really crucial here, that is absolutely critical to determine, is the thing that you sort of brushed off, which was that there was sort of there might be an alcohol or there might be a psychotropic drug use involved. And then you sort of moved pretty quickly by that. And I would say that I think it's important to stop there and take a look. Because if that is someone who's self-medicating, for example.
Well, she's gone to a doctor, but doesn't follow up on it, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, but mental health issues are very, very important to realize. One of the other things that's also very important to realize is that if you are particularly bright, and for the sake of argument, if you're a life coach and you're a counselor, let's just give you the benefit of the doubt and say maybe you have above average intelligence. one of the things that we find is that those of us who are bright are also easily bored in relationships. And we often end up in relationships with people who are mentally or emotionally unbalanced because it's interesting. I'm just curious. I know it's a laughable thing, but I'm being really serious. It's one of the things that can keep people in relationships that are dysfunctional. And so, you know, take a look at that and see where that dynamic might play a part in it. But then just getting back to the question about women changing their minds. Well, this has driven men nuts since the earliest history. You know, you hear this over and over in literature about the inconstancy of women. And I don't want to berate my own sex, but I will say that I think that is a common gender issue. Women can have really close relationships, and then they can get hurt or they have a fight or something goes wrong, and they'll sever that tie with that relationship. And it's especially difficult for women who are in adolescence. If you look at the way young women operate within their own subculture when they're teenagers, the way they treat each other, and the way they sort of fight for supremacy or for popularity, there are some pretty dysfunctional things that go on there. And if this person became involved in alcohol or drug abuse at an early age, they might be stuck in an adolescent level of emotional development. And one of the things that happens with alcohol and drug abuse is that it prevents us dealing with our emotional pain. But dealing with emotional pain is how we grow. So if they've been medicating since a fairly early age, they might be in a 30 or 40-year-old body, but you might be dealing with a 14-year-old brain or mind. So your expectations for adult behavior might be unreasonable from this individual. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, it absolutely makes sense. But my real question is, and maybe I'm too naive to see it right in front of me, but if you choose to accept the adventure, how might you win, for lack of a better term?
You won't win.
No, you won't win. You just need to fasten your seatbelt and turn and enjoy the ride.
Right. And you also can make a different type of contract with that person. You can make an eternal contract and a lifelong contract with someone who you choose not to live with.
Gotcha.
So that's something else you need to consider, because it's also important that you model for your child a healthy home life and a healthy relationship pattern.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, bear that in mind. You can have a very successful lifetime relationship with someone that you don't necessarily live with.
There are many
more options than those we usually think about.
I got you. Well, I'll give you a good example
of this. And somebody on the board just said it started out talking about how to love, and we ended up on gender issues. But obviously, as I said, those issues between men and women are the hardest ones to overcome and the greatest barriers to loving. But I know some people in New York City. The guy's a carpenter. He took over a building in right in Soho, and he remodeled it, and he built a loft for his wife and himself. And she had a child from another marriage. And this is just a good example of how people can do exactly what you just described, Crystal, and remain in love with each other and admit that, well, we just can't live with each other. Maybe it's just too painful, or we weren't meant to live together. But we can still love each other, and we can still, going forward, have a relationship that's eternal. Well, we know all relationships are eternal. If we believe we are eternal beings, then all relationships are eternal as well. And this couple inhabited the same building, and they bought this building together. And the father, the first husband bought the backside, and the second husband bought the front side and wife. And they raised their son Nick, and he went back and forth. He went from his, you know, and he would walk around the block and be with his dad, and then come back over and be with his mom and his stepdad. And they were all very good friends. They were very loving, very positive, and they created an environment for this child where he realized that just because two people can't live together doesn't mean that they can't love each other. And that's not always easy because, you know, everybody involved has to want that end result. And that's the tricky part, but I mean, it can be done if we keep our relationships in perspective, and if we don't add all of the judgment and the hurt and the shame and the blame, mm-hmm. we just realize, hey, you know, we couldn't live together. That's okay. It's not a crime.
Okay. Then there's another option that I don't want to leave off the table, and that is accepting things the way they are. And realizing that the majority of people who get divorced and who go on to other relationships end up in other relationships that are very similar to the ones they left, or possibly the total opposite of the one they left. But that
go ahead, Crystal. I'm sorry.
I was just saying that there are no perfect relationships out there. And wanting to win, or wanting this to work out, or really wanting to succeed in this relationship is only possible really if you have a mutual commitment to that. And sometimes people will choose to stay in relationships primarily as a service to the other. And that's not completely, you know, out of line either. I mean, I think there are many people who do that. We take it seriously for better or for worse. And we understand that sometimes we are married to people who have mental health issues. And we choose to stay in the relationship and do the best we can to help this person, you know, stay as stable as possible in a very challenging situation. And that is a very loving, very service-oriented type of decision to make, as long as you are making that decision consciously.
Gotcha. Thank
you
for that so much.
If you hang on for a second, we have Patrick Yesh who'd like to join the call. And I think Patrick could shed some light here, too. Hold on. I'll put him on. Patrick, are you with us?
I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Coming in loud and clear.
Oh, great. I wasn't sure whether I do this by phone or Skype or whatever. But anyhow, it's fun. It's great listening to you three. It's like you three are here in the kitchen with me. it's really fun. I love you all. You're just doing a wonderful, wonderful team job there. You make a great, powerful team of lovers. I can just hear it coming out of all of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just thinking how important some of the things you said, like what do men do when they want to defuse or get cool? Or I can probably just tell you what I do. Anyways, I try to get up into the mountains like Jesus did, you know, to the garden or the mountains, and just cool out and meditate and get in touch with the Father, really. That's it. And, you know, in sharing love and how to love people better and so on, it just seems to me when I'm in a situation that is like really humanly insurmountable and I'm knocking my head against the wall and feeling deserted or upset or things like that, I just really begin to focus on the presence of the adjuster in me. And as soon as I hit that place, I realize that the adjuster is in the other person too, right? God is in there. And I have a big sign in my house on the wall that the person that I love and my kids are adjusters, you know. And all of a sudden my attitude changes. I become more patient. I start adapting Jesus's mind and all those things that Durant's book tries to tell us to do to help us through this terrible human condition of all the things that you've been talking about, of being, you know, impatient and judging and all that kind of stuff.
So you're suggesting that, for instance, with Dave or with anybody that's involved in a relationship that's really, really challenging, that we essentially, you know, go to God and get at peace with God and even the... to find a God within that other person, and this is something that Jesus did as a technique. He would appeal directly to the spirit in another person. He would appeal directly to the best part of that person.
Exactly.
Try to bring out that beauty. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, exactly, and it's because it has to do with ourselves. You know, whenever you have a problem with someone else, you're usually projecting something within yourself. It's reflecting something within us, right? And it's very hard when you're really angry and pissed off at someone else. It's really hard to sit down, quiet your mind and your emotions. Emotions always override our intellect. I mean, that's just science, you know. As soon as you're in an emotional state, you are not logical anymore. You can't think. You have to drop down. You have to calm yourself down. And meditation and worship is a beautiful way to do that. But as soon as you do begin to worship and meditate, you come into the presence of the Father. I think I do, anyhow, when I do that. As soon as that happens, then I can center myself. As long as I'm out there arguing in my mind with the other person or trying to do one-upmanship or whatever, it just doesn't work. And I don't feel good. The only place I feel good is when I'm sitting in the presence of the Father. So I try to get there as fast as I can when I'm in mental trouble, really. And, you know, the other thing is humor. Humor is just such a medicine for relationship. And I just think people who can make me laugh. And I think lovers need to laugh a lot together and find, and it's necessary finding the humor in the other person, but finding your own sense of humor. I'm not
and
your own, but your own
at
humor on yourself, being able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I think that's a very, very important thing that you added right there to the discussion, Patrick, about how critical it is to learn to not take oneself or the other too seriously. And
mm-hmm.
and the ability to help your lover or your mate not take themselves so seriously also is also a gift. And
or your child.
Or your
child.
You know, a lot of when you're dealing with your own child, you see, Patrick, what you just said about reflecting or sometimes projecting something that's in you onto them inadvertently or even unconsciously. That happens in child-parental relationships a lot, because a lot of times you see in your child the things you don't like about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just genetics. They can't help it, you know.
I'll give you a good example, and I'm not quite sure how this fits in, but I was golfing with my son day before yesterday, my middle son, and we have a good relationship, but there are certain things that I say and do, and I can tell he's getting irritated with me. And it's so funny because my mom says and does the exact same things to me, and it irritates me. And I can't help it. I am just like, a lot of people call me Betty Jr. because I'm just like my mother, and I'm the same way with my son, and, you know, he'll probably be the same way with his son or daughter. It's just so funny how life goes on like that and how there's these patterns. It's like Dave was saying that he had this sort of unpredictable relationship of when he was growing up, and now he's attracted and in love with a woman who's got the same sort of thing going on. And we just can't help those patterns and those things that we fall into. And so, you know, getting out of it, do we want to get out of it? I don't really think we do. I think we want to go right through that situation. That's why it's there.
Well, and I think that we can be the salt that restores the savor. You know, I'm reminded of that great story from the life and teachings of Jesus with the and it goes again back to what you've said all along here, Andrea, about responding in crystalline too, instead of reacting. And if you want, I can read this. It's short, but it's so beautiful and so powerful. It's from paper 130, the life and teachings of Jesus at Caesarea. It's his private ministry as he went about through Rome right before he began his public ministry with his apostles. It says, one of the young men who worked with Jesus one day on the steering paddle became much interested in the words which he dropped from hour to hour as they toiled in the shipyard. When Jesus intimated that the Father in heaven was interested in the welfare of his children on earth, this young Greek, Anaxand, said, if the gods are interested in me, then why do they not remove the cruel and unjust foreman of this workshop? He was startled when Jesus replied, since you know the ways of kindness and value justice, perhaps the gods have brought this erring man near you that you may lead him into a better way. Maybe you are the salt which is to restore his savor, make this brother more agreeable to all other men. That is, if you have not lost your savor. As it is, this man is your master, and that his evil ways unfavorably influence you. Why not assert your mastery of evil by the virtue of the power of goodness, and thus become the master of all relations between the two of you? I predict that the good in you could overcome the evil in him if you give it a fair and living chance. You know, so often we become a victim in life, and we don't see the situations we're in as an opportunity to really make a difference in another person's life, and that really is about unselfishness. I think those primary relationships, though, the male-female relation, for you to make a real change in the world, you need to have the loving support and understanding that will allow you to go out and do good things. You know what I mean? If you can't come home, if your home life is in turmoil all the time, you're not going to have much energy to do anything good in the world.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, your home has to be a place where you pick up energy and you give each other energy and you support and each other, and physically, mentally, spiritually, and everything else. You know, if humor is the divine antidote for the exaltation of ego, we get into trouble when we get into ego, don't we? But, you know, we should have a Urantia humor blog or something like that, or a divine spiritual humor place that we can all get lessons and go to school on how to be funnier and take ourselves
less
seriously.
Oh, that's a brilliant, brilliant idea. I second that idea.
So what happened?
I think
that's
really critical, because I think that there's almost nothing more important than that good sense of humor and the ability to not take oneself too seriously, especially in those life crises moments and in relationship crises moments. I mean, there's nothing more healing to a fight, you know, than a good laugh.
Isn't it true? Hey, say, Andrea, what happened to you and your son? So what was the end of that story? I think you mentioned that.
So we were golfing together. We were teeing off. We were getting ready to move from the 10th to the 11th hole. And I said, I'm really ticking you off here. And I said, I'm sorry. You know, it's the exact same way my mother ticks me off. And we both had a good laugh. And he said, yeah, you're Betty Jr. and I'm Andrea Jr.
We're all little juniors, aren't we?
Yeah, we're all little juniors.
Those things are powerful. I mean, you'd like to think that, you know, genetics doesn't come into play, but oh my gosh, it really, really does.
Remember what they
said?
It's genetics plus the environment. The environment we grew up in, you know, it talk about hardwiring us. You know.
Well, you know, speaking of this topic, I'd love to interject here and ask Paula, because you shared this with me recently, the difference between growing up with a child who's genetically your offspring and a child who you adopted. from another family, where you don't know much about her genetic makeup. Do you mind?
No, you know, it's just been a real interest to me as she's grown up to discover her. And to discover her gifts and her traits and her talents and her natural aptitudes and her natural abilities. You know, when you grow up in a family, and my family is, you know, predominantly Celtic, and we're storytellers, and we would talk and we would reminisce, and you get a sense about who you are and who your ancestors are, and maybe every family's like that, I think. And I hope. Because that's one of the best things about my family. One of the things I love is the fact that we would share stories about, you know, ancestors and my grandmother. You know, your grandmother kind of connects you to the past, and it's an oral tradition that should be kept alive in families, I think. It's rich and beautiful. But when you adopt a child, you don't know what that child's ancestry is. I mean, you can get a general sense just by studying. My daughter May is from China. And the Urantia book says that the Chinese are ultra-Pacific. Well, I've seen that in her. She is ultra-Pacific. She, you know, she doesn't want to strive with people. She's not a contender. She doesn't, you know, she's peaceful in her heart. And I had somebody tell me once, you know, when she comes into a group of children, they all calm down. And that was startling for me to hear. She was only 3 years old when her daycare person told me this. And so, you know, genetics is huge. And one thing that I've noticed about this is what we were just talking about. I would get irritated with my children for exhibiting some characteristic that my mother had that I didn't like about my mother, you know. And if you get irritated, or you say things like, gee, I hope you wouldn't get my big butt, or, you know, I don't know. You, in your own children, you know, you see genetics. You just see them. They repeat through families, and there they are.
Whereas, doesn't the Urantia book say something about that? That's true art when, you know, when things get passed on through the family. I can't remember what the quote is.
Well, that was one of the original reasons why they believe in ghosts. Because they would see traits in the child that were in the grandfather, and so they just thought that was the grandfather coming back again in the child, you know. But
Right. Really,
it was just genetic. Of course, primitive people didn't know that.
Right.
But yeah,
you
so
know that.
Hey, I actually prayed that the father would reveal to me what her gifts were, so I could help her develop them.
Nice.
You know, because you know that in your own children, but in an adopted child, you don't know that. And so, you know, it's a great discovery, though. It's a wonderful, beautiful discovery to make. And
yeah, one of my children is adopted, too, and she's always a surprise. And in terms of laughter and humor, I laugh with her a lot, and I know her mom and her just go into hysterics. They've been together since birth, actually. We adopted her at birth, so no, she's just marvelous. You never know what they're going to do next, but you do after watching them, for she's 23, Autumn, and she's always beautiful to watch and to see how she develops her characteristics. She's a real person who likes to help other people and anticipate that, and that's so beautiful to watch, and I know her mom helped her to develop that, too. So, and the sense of humor comes with living together and sharing lots of things. I think that's where our sense of humor really comes. And the Urantia book says our humor later on is reflecting on our past, the way we used to be. That's some of our greatest sense, that's some of the places where we get most of our humor from later on. It's reminiscence, they say. So that's cool. It's the way Andrea and her son were talking about themselves as they begin to see themselves as their parents, you know. That's really interesting stuff. And I think even an adopted child acts very much like the mother that brings them up, because that's how we model.
And I think the culture that you grow up in models that for you as well, because as you all, most of you know, I grew up in a different culture. And I had a chance to connect with a friend that I'd had in college just for a brief time, very intense friendship, but it was only for about a year or two. And the person, when I contacted them again, said, the thing that they remembered most about me, or that really stood out for them, was that I had this really different sense of humor. And this was in the northern Midwest, where people are more reserved. And growing up in West Africa, where people are really out, you know, they really don't hold a lot back, especially when it came to humor. They just laugh a lot. I mean, a lot of laughter is just the norm. And it really comes home to me when I get on the phone with the man who took care of my brother and myself when we were really little. And every time we speak with him on the phone, we spend the first 2 minutes, at least 2 minutes, if not longer, just laughing.
Wow.
As soon as he hears our voice, he'll go into peals of laughter. And it's how he expresses his joy. It's just this unbridled joy of being together with him. And it doesn't matter how long it's been since we've spoken, but we just have this incredible joy of being together, and that's expressed through just this, you know, head back, loud, very expressive laughter. And it occurred to me, you know, recently when we were on the phone, oh my gosh, that's why we do, this is why my brother and I laugh like this. Because this is the man who raised us in our very earliest years. You know, I had a very unusual situation in that most of my caregivers were men when I was very young. My mom worked, and our babysitters were men. So we had a much more intimate kind of relationship than you would with a babysitter, because this was someone who was with us most of the time. But yeah, just laughing together was such a healing way to deal with conflict. If you can get to
that point, and that's where grace comes in, and some good techniques, and just being able to realize, you know, here we are mired into this situation, but, you know, there's a bigger picture here. And I guess that's one of the things that I love about the Urantia book, because it does give you such a grand idea about how, you know, what our place in the universe is. We're so incredibly special, and yet we're down here so low. There's really a lot to laugh about here.
Maybe that's why God made us creatures, so we can have something to laugh at as we grow through the universe.
Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah.
I never thought of that, but boy, we're so imperfect down here. I'm working with the Indians, and they're so much fun to work with, and why I like working with them up here, the Sioux, their Sioux group, because they're always kidding you. I can't be in the classroom with them teaching art and so on without them making me go into hysterics and always catching me at something that's very human and making fun of it. We all laugh a lot. I was like squeezing a tube of paint the other day and it was stuck and I couldn't get it going. And I'm going, oh, you need this particular color. You need it really bad. And I pushed really hard and it squirted right over her back, on her clothes, up her arm. It was just so funny. And she gave me this straight face like, you know, there was absolutely no emotion while I ran and got a big cloth and tried to clean off her arm and stuff. It was so funny. And everybody was in hysterics. Nobody got uptight. But, you know, I come off being really human in that class rather than this great teacher of art, you know. So it's funny. A funny situation. But they love it. And every other sentence in the Indian culture here is, they're always laughing. You can't walk down the hallway or anything. You go into the office and the secretaries, it's a laughing culture. It's very much like what you're saying, Kristalyn. The same thing. You know, the older cultures really know how to use humor to defuse. And I think we got to have that in our life now. You know, the things are pretty tough down here, and they tell us it's a difficult planet. So we might as well develop a heck of a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for the people who I'm close to who are teaching me more and more about humor every day. Love them a lot. Even my children, they're
no,
really...
No, I...
Go ahead.
For me, personally, I had an experience of humor that was so powerful in my understanding when I was grieving, when my dad died when I was 20, and I grieved for 2 years. And there was a point in time when no matter what thought of my dad I had, whether it be a happy memory or you know, in which most of them were, it would make me cry, and I would grieve. And I knew that I had finished the grieving process when I could have that same thought of my dad and just laugh.
Oh.
And laugh. Such a feeling of love and joy in my heart, you know. Your Rancher book really helped me with that. I mean, I don't know if I ever could have gotten there without the Rancher book, because it told me exactly where my dad was, you know, and what he was up to and what was happening to him and the whole life after death. You know, the teachings of life after death from the Rancher book are just amazing, unsurpassed. I think you can't beat them, but that really helped me know that my dad still existed somewhere and that he was going on and he was learning and, you know, growing. And he actually came back in dreams and revealed that to me, both me and my sister and my mom, because we were all grieving so bad. But still, the sorrow and loneliness I felt when I would think of him, and tears would just pour down my face. And I knew I had turned a corner when I could have that same thought of something he did or said and just laugh.
Hmm.
I knew
wow.
that real healing occurred. That laughter is good medicine, but it's also a good sign, you know. And my dad was gifted at being able, when you were so sad, to make you laugh. And the minute he made you laugh, he would completely forget about what you were sad about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that ability to get somebody out of their own head by making them laugh is a gift. What a gift that is. I just can't emphasize enough, Patrick, how right you are, that laughter is a tool.
Oh, yeah, I remember I was really upset about a mortgage that I had to pay and everything, and called my mother and was whining, as I typically do. But she laughed, and I said, "Why are you laughing? I'm upset." And she says, "Welcome to the human race." She was just, you know, with one sentence, she could diffuse everything. It was just funny. The older we get, I think we can help our kids out by making them laugh, too, about situations they think are too serious.
Well, and we do, I think, take ourselves, we have the ability to take ourselves very seriously. And when you look at that propensity from a universe perspective, it's hysterically funny.
Mm-hmm, right.
I mean, it really is funny, because it's like, here you are, this, like, human, thinking that this stuff that you're going through is so important and is so serious. And it's just not.
That's probably why they tell us when they ask us in one of those things to ask the thought adjuster to give us the long-range view. That would do it right away.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, we're almost at the end of our show, you guys, and it's been so great. It was a great show, Andrea. Thank you so much for coming on. And I just want to recap some of the things we've touched on for our listeners, that how to learn to love more, get to know each other better, know your neighbor's motives and sentiments, learn to take yourself less seriously, learn to laugh and communicate better. Can any of you think of something anything else that we touched on that might help people get to love each other better?
Oh, see the adjustment. See God and the other person, yeah.
One last thing one last thing that I would really like to add is the importance of really confiding in one another and trusting each other with our real inner selves. I think that's a really important part of getting to love one another. When we can reveal
communication,
have the courage to confide in one another, to tell each other the truth about who we are. If you really knew me, you would know this about me.
Yeah.
Respond
rather than react. That was a good one too.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, I hope it was helpful, friends, and having you on. Patrick, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having
and
me.
Andrew, it was delightful to have you. And, of course, you know, you're invited back anytime you want to come back.
Oh, thank you.
We always love talking to you. Thanks for the work
you're doing.
We're
here every Saturday morning except last Saturday.
One of those human things.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to everyone on our board, Lou, Bro Dave, all of you guys. It's always great to see you there, and thanks for all you contribute. Really, really appreciate it. And we hope to see you back next week on the Cosmic Citizen.
Thanks, Paula. Thanks, Crystalline. Thanks, Patrick.
Until we meet again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio